City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.
Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9.
Richard Madeley is one of the best-known faces on television. As one half of Richard and Judy, with his wife Judy Finnegan, of course, he's been brightening our mornings, or easing us into evening, for nigh on 20 years. In fact, the Madeleys have just launched a new show, Richard and Judy's New Position, which goes out on the digital station Watch TV. Now, if you've seen what they do, and let's face it, who hasn't, you'll know that one of the reasons they're so popular is because they always seem natural and relaxed in front of the cameras. And indeed, they're exactly like they are off camera as they are on camera, which is totally refreshing. And it's easy to forget you're actually watching two journalists who happen to be a married couple. Well, Richard and Judy wrote a joint autobiography in 2003, which gave us a bit of an insight into how they became Britain's best-known TV double act. But last month, Richard published his own book, Fathers and Sons, a family history with a difference. Using memories and passed down family stories, Richard has written about his father, his grandfather, and his own experience of what it means to be a dad. And if you thought you'd got the measure of him as an easygoing guy with a daft sense of humour, you may be in for a bit of a surprise. This book deals with some hefty themes and big emotions, such as how lack of love and negative parenting can reverberate across the generations. And I'm very pleased to say that Richard joins us now to tell us more. Hi, Richard.
Hello, that was a very nice introduction.
Thank you very much. It could have been even more syrupy, you know. What made you write the book in the first place?
Oh, I'd love to give you a sort of a wonderful literary story and say that, you know, I sort of woke up at 3 a.m, inspired, and sort of raced downstairs and made notes. But actually, the book was born over a cold pizza in a pizza hut in South London. My literary agent, had come to basically nag me, because he's been going on to me to write a book for ages, and he'd come up with two or three ideas, which all of which I didn't like at all. And so he was sulking, and I tried to divert him by just as we sat gloomily over these congealed pizzas by telling him a bit of my backstory. And I started with my grandfather, which is indeed where the book starts. Yes. And after about 3 minutes, he just thumped the table, dropped his knife and fork, and his eyes were shining. He said, "That's it. That's your book. And it's going to be called Fathers and Sons," he said, "and it's going to start with your grandfather." And he said, and did what you just told me about your grandfather have a major effect on your father?" And I said, "Yes, it did." He said, "And did that have an effect on you?" And I said, "Yes, it did." And he said, and were you able to deal with that with your own son?" I said, "Yes, I think so." He said, "Right, that's the book then." And so that it was born, and I kind of walked away inspired and began writing.
But, you know, as every journalist knows, a good journalist starts with lots of research. So what was your journey into research like? Did you have to talk to a lot of family members?
I didn't have to do a great deal of research, no, because many of the stories, certainly in the first half of the book before I was born, are kind of family legends that I've known as long as I can remember, really. Sort of a spoken memory that's been passed on from generation to generation. The research I had to do did throw up some very, very interesting sort of highlights, which I'll come to in a second. But no, a lot of it, I'd say probably 70% of the book was in my head right from the start. And obviously my own experiences as a son and as a father were obviously in my head. I did have to go and interview my mother, which was a slightly strange experience. but not nearly as strange as actually. There is a talking version of the book, which I recorded. And in the second part of the book, my mother enters the story, and I have quotes from her in the book, and I found myself having to impersonate my mother as I was reading. It was very strange, very strange.
But she loved that.
She's a Canadian, so I was speaking in a high-pitched Canadian accent. But no, I'd say most of the information in the book is kind of part of my DNA, really.
But that would have been the sort of solid information. From that, you would have had to surely sit down and work out, how has this affected me? You would have had to ask maybe some pretty obvious questions, but be very honest with yourself.
Yes, I think that process was actually sort of undertaken in the writing of the book. I sort of discovered how things and events had bounced on into the next generation and kind of rippled within its own generation as I wrote it. I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, my grandfather was abandoned in 1907. He was 10 years old, and he was in a family of about 6 or 7 siblings, and his father ran a business in Worcester, which went bust. And back in 1907, there was no way that you could sort of go on benefits or anything. He and his whole family, his wife, he had a baby, younger children, my granddad, who was 10, older brothers, all of them were going to be out on the street or in the gutter or in the equivalent of the workhouse within weeks. Mm. So he went up to Shropshire, a little place called Shawbury, where he had an older brother who ran a farm there and basically begged for help, begged for money. And his older brother, who frankly turns out to be quite a devil, as the book unrolls, his older brother offered him a deal. He said he'd give him all the money that the family needed, all of them, the parents, all the children, to emigrate to Canada. And some stake money that they could set up a business when they got there. And in return, he didn't want repaying in cash or kind. he simply wanted one of the children to stay behind and work off the debt on the farm. And he picked my granddad, who at 10 was just about the right age to start work. And the deal was that granddad had to stay there until he was 21, by which time it would be decreed that the debt was discharged. And that was the deal they did.
But granddad didn't know about that,
no,
did he? He was all excited, waiting to go off with the rest of the family on the big ship and woke up and everyone had gone.
Absolutely. Flash forward a few weeks and they're overnighting at the farm on the way to Liverpool to catch the boat. And as you say, my granddad thought he was going with them. All the rest of them, except his father, thought that he was going with them. And he woke up, as you say, the next morning to an empty farmhouse. They'd all gone and only his luggage was left. And he actually thought, poor little child, that he thought that they'd forgotten him. He thought in all the hubbub of leaving at 3 a.m. to catch the boat, he'd somehow been overlooked. But no, he went downstairs and his uncle was there, this Uncle William, who, without any attempt to wrap it up, told him his fortune, said that he basically had been swapped in return for tickets to Canada and he was going to stay there for the next 11 years. And that's what happened.
And you think that feeling of betrayal and maybe that feeling that you can't trust people has rippled down through the generations?
Yes, definitely. I mean, by the time my father was born in 1928, it wasn't just that first incredible reversal of fortune that had affected my grandfather, as I say in the book. There were a number of other serious betrayals, mostly at the hands of this Uncle William, who really was an awful man. Had left my grandfather so battered and bruised that, like a lot of people who've gone through some very bad emotional experiences, he withdrew. He didn't become a cruel man, but he became a very, very removed and cold person. And so he showed no affection whatsoever to his son. He just was incapable of doing it by then. And my dad grew up in this sort of extraordinary, cold, bleak kind of landscape. And that had a major effect on him. When he was 15, he was packed off to a shockingly bad boarding school in Staffordshire in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the war, which was a real exile. And we've never got to the bottom of why that happened to him. It just seemed to be a kind of a random act of coldness. And so by the time he was grown up, he was a seriously screwed up guy, my dad. He was very, very unhappy. He felt rejected and he felt that he was unlovable.
But did he feel, I'm not going to make the same mistakes or I'm going to try and change things with my sons, i.e. you?
Yes, he did. He emigrated to Canada himself, oddly enough, after the war, where he met my mum, and he was exposed to kind of a real happy family. My mother's parents were very happy together. They had they just had a young baby by accident. My mother had a younger sister and an older brother. And it was a very happy, kind of modern, forward-looking North American existence. And very tactile and sort of, emotional and warm and loving. And my father saw this at first hand and realized that there was another way of living a family life, and he kind of resolved that when he and my mother had children, he'd be like that. And for the most part, I have to say, he managed to reverse that dreadful sort of flow that had gone into his life, with an exception. But by the time I was about 8, Dad had been a great dad, but there was still a lot of buried anger in him, I think, and disappointment from the past. And he became quite violent for a couple of years towards me. He used to beat me quite badly with a stick, which was a real aberration. That was out of his normal behaviour.
How did that affect you? Because I have an exact parallel, same with me. He was about 8 years of age, and that started happening with me. And it does for a daughter to a father, but for a son, you seem to think this is the way things are always going to be, and suddenly it changes.
Yes,
and there's a part of you, while you're being hit, thinking, what's going on?
Yes, absolutely, exactly right. It was a complete shock, because I'd never been hit in my life before, except, the occasional scrape at school with other kids. My parents had never hit me, my father had certainly never hit me, and I did something on this particular day on the first occasion, and I have no idea what it was now, but a tiny, tiny infraction. And my dad blew up, really lost his temper, and told me to face the wall. And he left the room, and I was looking at the wall. And I didn't remember this detail until I was writing the book, but I was staring at a painting that my maternal grandmother had made of a lake in Canada with leaves on the surface and rocks poking through. And I thought maybe my punishment was to count the leaves or something, or count these rocks. And I heard the shed door open out in the garden. It made a particular noise because it scraped on the path. And up until that day, that noise of our shed door being opened was simply that, the shed door being opened. But after this day, it always produced a real Pavlovian response to me. I used to get, butterflies in my stomach and have a dry mouth, because it was the sound of my father going to get a stick. And he came back in on this first occasion. I'm still staring at the wall. He had a stick in his hand, but I didn't know that at that point, because I was I had my back to him. And there was a moment's silence, and then I actually thought, and I write this in the book, and it sounds like a metaphor, but it's a literal description of what I thought. I thought my legs had caught fire, because we had a fire burning in the corner, and I thought a coal had come out and caught light of my socks and trousers. And then I thought my buttocks had caught fire. I was absolutely bewildered and in real pain, and I sort of spun round to see what was going on. And there was my father with a contorted face with an expression I'd never seen on it before, and this big cane whistling through the air in a horizontal arc, which was meant to hit my shoulder blades, but I turned round by then, and it hit my upper arm on the muscle, which was incredibly painful. And down I went on both knees. And then he sort of threw the stick aside and shouted something like, and don't do it again, or let that be a lesson, or whatever, and left the room. And another detail that I'd forgotten until I actually wrote this down a few months ago was I then thought that, as I was kind of crouched there, I thought that my mother had come back home because she'd been out shopping and had put the, put the kettle on because I could hear a whistling sound. And then I realised it was actually me. It was this kind of high, keening sort of scream that was coming from me, sort of involuntarily. And that was, yeah, that was the beginning of a two-year sort of a series of episodes, which were bewildering.
And to me, the way you describe it, that you can still almost see it and smell it and feel
absolutely.
It, means that it stuck with you. Do certain things now as an adult remind you, take you back there? Or you said, like, Pavlov's dogs, do you still get that...
Not really. I mean, the sticks that he used came from a pile of bamboo canes that he used on his in the garden. And I can pass a bamboo stick in somebody's front yard now without a kind of a shudder. or I can see a caning sequence in a film set in a boarding school or something without sort of, you know, having a dry mouth again. No, interestingly, a lot of people asked me if in writing about that episode and others,
it
was a kind of catharsis or, you know, a release. But it wasn't, because when I was 10, my father beat me for the last time, and so severely I couldn't go to school. And my mother threatened to go to the police, and it all came to a kind of a complete stop then. And he kind of woke up and realized what he'd been doing and gave me the most extraordinarily intense apology and an attempt to explain what had been going on and telling me that it was nothing to do with me or my behaviour, and a solemn promise that he'd never do it again.
And that must have helped.
It helped a lot because it was true. He never hit me again. And I realised within a few months of that promise and that explanation and that apology that he was sincere, and it rebuilt the relationship. And I didn't really need any catharsis because his the way he dealt with it and withdrew from that very bad place he'd got to did the trick.
That would have taken a lot of courage for him, because I'd say, again, as I say, similar situation, but to the fact that I've never had an explanation, that's what leaves the door open to other feelings. You've been able to move on. I wanted to ask you, did you discover anything in the book that really shocked or surprised you?
Yes, I something which as a journalist, sent goosebumps going up both arms when I was told this detail. I mentioned my grandfather being abandoned. And he didn't see his family until he got to Canada in 1921.
Yes.
But something happened in 1917, which was 10 years after he'd been left on the farm, which I didn't know about until I spoke to an aunt. And it's quite an extraordinary thing. He was 20 by now. He, as I say, his family had been in Ontario for 10 years, and he wasn't going to see them for another two or three more. And he'd enlisted in the army, and the Great War was at its height. And he found himself on a troop train going down to the trenches, to the boats that would take them across the channel to France. And it stopped, this big troop train, it stopped in Crewe Station to be recoaled and rewatered. And another train pulled up alongside it and stopped. And that, too, was full of troops. And my granddad was looking through the window at it, and he suddenly realized that their uniforms were a little bit different from his own. And then it clicked. They were Canadians. They were Canadian soldiers. Mm. And he suddenly remembered that he'd had a letter from his mother in Ontario about 2 months before, saying that his two older brothers, who he'd last seen the night he'd gone to bed in Shawbury 10 years before, had enlisted as well and were likely to be coming overseas to fight. And he just suddenly got this extraordinary sort of dart of animal instinct that they were on that very train. So he jumped up and went into the officer's compartment and asked for permission to board the other train and explained. And they laughed in his face. And they placed bets on the odds that he might find even one of them. But they let him go. He had 5 minutes before his train left. And if he missed his train, he'd be accused of desertion. So he ran across to the other platform, jumped onto this other train, full of these Canadian soldiers. And it was like that scene in Saving Private Ryan, you know, when Tom Hanks is going through all those GIs and saying, is there a Ryan here? Has anyone seen a Ryan in this unit? Well, that was my granddad in 1917 going down this Canadian troop train saying, has anyone heard of a Madeley? Are there any Madeleys in this division? Any Madeleys in this unit? And he got to the second or third carriage, and there they both were. His two older brothers.
Gosh.
Sitting on a bench, looking out of the window, and there they stood, staring at each other. Now, we don't know what they said, because it's nearly 100 years ago.
Yes.
But we know a few things. One, he would have been amazed to look at them, at these grown-up brothers in Canadian soldiers' uniforms, speaking in Canadian accents to him.
Yes.
They would have, of course, last remembered him in his little wee willy winky nightshirt when he was 10, and there is this 20-year-old with a gun over his back and a helmet on his head, staring at them.
God.
So they would have had an incredibly intense encounter. And we know that they exchanged details of the units that they were serving in, so they could meet up if they got some leave in France, you know, behind the trenches. And then he had to run back to his train, the whistle was going, and he just caught it in time. And he never saw his older brother again, because the older guy, who he worshipped, was killed at Vimy Ridge, a big Canadian assault there about 2 weeks later, so he never saw his older brother again.
But at least he'd seen him.
But he did get one quick reconciliation with them both.
Now, let's come to you. What kind of a dad are you?
Oof, that's a big question.
Maybe you should ask your children.
Well, actually, Jack, my son, and I have two stepsons as well from Judy's first marriage, Jack actually has written the epilogue to my book. And he writes beautifully. And he's really sweet in it. And he says, towards the end of his final chapter, he says that what he reads into the book is that it's about forgiveness. Because in the end, my grandfather forgave his father for abandoning him, and my father forgave his father, my grandfather, for being so cold. You know, to understand all is to forgive all, I think.
Yes,
and I forgave my father for beating me. And Jack says that, you know, that this strand of forgiveness runs through the book like a spine. And then he says, but when it comes to him, and this is what brought tears to my eyes, he said, I've nothing to forgive. You know, these sins of the fathers, he said, have been sort of quietly evaporated in the telling and have not been visited on me. And you know, he says he's had a very happy childhood. So that was a huge relief to read that. Because I said to him, Jack, write what you like. I mean, you know, really, write exactly
Yeah, then you
what
didn't
you
sleep.
Yes, exactly.
But you're kind of the new age guy, if you like, or new man, before the term was even invented, really.
Well, I think if that's true, I think it's because I married a feminist. I mean, you know, Judy is a proto-feminist. I mean, she read The Female Eunuch in, you know, by Germaine Greer in about 1969, 1970, and it transformed her. And and she's not a strident feminist in the way that, you know, one has come to associate that word, but she's very, very, very hot on women's rights.
Yes,
and on,
yes,
you know, the
is.
Responsibilities and duties of a father and a husband to sort of share responsibilities. So I was under no illusions when I married her how it was going to work out. And I think that's been good for our kids, and I think it's been good for me.
And the other thing is, being a parent, though, in the public eye, does that add problems, do you think? Do you think it adds problems to being a dad?
I think it might if fame came late on. You know, I think if you had children and then, I don't know, then you went on to the X Factor or something and sort of became a sort of an overnight name, it might, yes, I'm sure it would cause the issues and problems. But you see, our kids were born that expression, born in a trunk. I mean, they were almost born in a TV studio. Judy and I were on air together.
Yes.
Doing This Morning before Chloe was, or shortly after Chloe was born, and Jack was only one and a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So they've grown up with their parents being on the telly and being sort of, you know, reasonably well known. And to them, it's normal.
I'm not saying
they think that having parents who aren't known is abnormal, because they know that it's strange. It's a very odd thing to have a public profile like you do.
Yes,
but they're completely comfortable with it, and I don't think it's spoiled them or held them back in any way.
No, but that's because you and Judy are so down to earth. Are you worried? I read somewhere that Chloe's going to do the dancing, Strictly Dancing. Is,
no,
is she going?
She's not. I mean, Chloe increasingly, she's just been asked to go on Celebrity Big Brother, and she's very wisely turned that down.
Very wisely.
Very wisely. No, she's actually, Chloe's doing reports for our new evening show. She's doing a little thing called Chloe's Angels, which is very funny. It's her and...
Is that scary, though, having a daughter in the same industry?
If I was an actor and she just got a part in a small part in a West End play, you'd probably ask the same question. Because they've got a handle on the whole thing. I mean, Chloe is the least sort of starry person I know, actually, and she sees working in television as I do
as a very
fortunate, happy job. Yeah, it's a job, and in many ways, I often say this: if you land the right kind of program for you, it's like going to a party. Excuse me, it's like going to a party. Being like, you know what it's like. It's fun. It's exciting.
It's not like working.
It's not like working a lot of the time. Although there is some drudgery, and there is the negative side, which is the negative feedback that you get in the media and stuff. But you have to accept that. And I've always said to Chloe and to Jack, who's also working in the media but behind the cameras, I've always said to them that if you do go in front of camera, if you do end up, you know, being a quote celebrity unquote, you must not take yourself remotely seriously, because nobody else will. And if you take yourself seriously and over the distance, you're going to read things about yourself that you're going to hate, that have the power to upset you. But they won't upset you if you don't take yourself seriously. And I don't take myself remotely seriously.
No, you don't. And finally, have you ever wondered what your career might have been like without Judy?
Yes, I have, actually. And it's one of those huge hypotheticals, and I'm sure she has too. It's one of those huge hypotheticals. I mean, you know, we make our moves, don't we? We sort of make our choices and that's it. You know, we're on tracks. I don't know. I mean, I was doing okay before Judy and I started presenting together. I was sort of the main presenter on the regional news show. She was doing well too, doing other regional programs. And I was just starting to break into network television. I was doing through quizzes. I was doing a quiz called Runway.
Yes.
And I was in the line to do a couple of daily chat shows for the BBC. So I think I would have worked in the same field, but I very much doubt that I would have sort of achieved the kind of notoriety or celebrity or whatever you want to use if Judy and I hadn't been together. And I think she feels the same about herself. I think we would have had a perfectly comfortable career I think we probably both would have evolved into network television presenters.
Yes,
but
yes.
I'm sure it would have been more of a kind of jobbing profession rather than these long periods working on you know, big sequence programmes.
Yes. So what's next? Another book?
Yeah, I woke up. Now I can give you a literary answer. I woke up the other Sunday. It was really weird. I mean, I've been wanting to write a novel for a long time, but I've never ever had the vaguest idea what it should be about. But I woke up the other Sunday. It was really odd, with a family living in my head, a mother and a father, and two grown-up children. And I know exactly where they live. They live in just under the Weald in Kent.
Yes.
And it's not, and I know when they live. It's 1938, and it's at the time of the Munich crisis. And I know what's going to happen to them, and I know the pain they're about to go through, and they're going to have a terrible sort of event in their lives, and how they're going to deal with it. And it's all there. It's all in my head.
It's a novel.
Weird. Yeah,
a novel.
It's odd. It's like being haunted.
So does Judy know about this?
I told her about it, and she gave me some helpful hints on some of the later details. But yeah, but it's a lovely feeling. So I've written down a synopsis.
Great.
I don't know about you, but if when you write, you've got to get it. You've got to make notes quickly. Otherwise, it evaporates from your head.
Yes, you need a pad and a pen by the side of the bed.
You absolutely do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing that, but we should tell people at the moment that it's a great Christmas present. I think, especially for dads,
or
Richard.
Or fathers and sons.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
I think it's brilliant. Because I think fathers and sons could read this book and use it as a topic, as a springboard to discussing things.
Well, I must say, I've been doing a lot of signings around the country, and I must say I've been getting a lot of feedback on exactly that line.
And
also from mothers, and particularly mothers and sisters of men who have got a difficult relationship with their dads. They have taken quite a lot from the book. And as I say, I mean, without going into the detail of it, because we've done that now, but really, forgiveness from son to father is very often the only way to move forward.
But also understanding, and that requires some opening up or some explanation or some insights
Absolutely
into what's
right.
going on.
Yes, you do need to know why. You need to know if there are problems. There's always going to be a reason for a father behaving badly to his son, always. It's not just going to be a random piece of wickedness, although I suppose that is possible. But usually there is something behind it. And if you can understand that, you can find a way to deal with it.
Okay, so there we go. A great Christmas present,
Thank
I
you.
Would have thought, for fathers and sons or mothers and sisters. Richard, it's been lovely talking to you. Do give my love to Judy.
And she sends hers to you as well.
And my husband sends his great, his very best wishes to you, because he never forgets when we first came over from Australia and he was bewildered in a totally new country, that you phoned up and spoke to him. Not me, I was the one on the box, but you were sweet enough to say, look, mate, I'm here. And and he just got blown away. And every time he sees you on TV, he says, that guy actually rang me up and gave a damn about me.
Well, we're all in the same boat in this world. And we have to reach out a bit sometimes. When I've been in difficult times, it's the kindness of strangers that you remember. It's those small gestures from people that you've never met that really count, you know?
Yes, and I do remember how sweet both you and Judy were to me when I first came over.
Well, you're lovely, that's why.
Oh, this is turning into a lovey fest. I better let you go, Richard.
All right, darling.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so the book's called Fathers and Sons by Richard Madeley, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And, of course, you've probably already seen it out in the shops. I really do recommend it, because when you read it, it's as if Richard is in your living room or your bedroom. Lots of ladies say, but it's as if he's actually there with you talking. It's really written in his words. Fathers and Sons. You're listening to Talk to Tricia here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool.
Listen and log on to the voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.